Welcome to our podcast, Psychiatric Services, From Pages to Practice. In this podcast, we highlight new research or columns published this month in the journal Psychiatric Services. I'm Lisa Dixon, editor of Psychiatric Services, and I'm here with podcast editor and my co-host, Josh Berezin. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Lisa.
Today, we're going to talk about three articles from the journal that have recently been published online. The first two are going to be focused on first episode psychosis care, one on disparities, the other on literacy. And the third is on a really interesting topic that was new to me.
New to me too.
Which is apparently widely spread in the UK, a topic called recovery colleges. So let's get started.
Sounds good. First up, we have Oladunni Oluwoye and colleagues on racial ethnic disparities in first episode psychosis treatment outcomes from the RAISE ETP study. So this, once again, is something that you're a topic that you're very familiar with.
Absolutely. It's really the whole maybe transformation occurring around early psychosis care is very exciting. And so the topic of disparities in the context of early psychosis care is really important.
Right. And they start out with some very striking statistics and pretty disturbing statistics, too, about non-Hispanic blacks being five times more likely than non-Hispanic whites to be given a diagnosis of schizophrenia. And also just pointing out that minority groups with psychotic disorders have higher rates of involuntary hospitalizations, interactions with law enforcement. So the disparities are real, they're there, they're large, and they also have really dire consequences for the population.
Absolutely. I think way back early in my career, I wrote a paper that looked at the higher rates of diagnosis of schizophrenia among African Americans. This is a finding that's been around for a while, and frankly, there's been very little done, as far as I can see, to unpack and remedy the situation.
So the outside of the racial ethnic disparities, though, there has been a lot of work done that you've been really integral in, actually, in treatment modalities for first episode psychosis. And this study is drawing on a lot of that research. So I wanted you to kind of give us a sense of the RAISE ETP and
sure.
Navigate studies.
Sure. Yeah. So this is a secondary analysis of data from the RAISE Early Treatment Program study, which some people think of as the Navigate study, because Navigate was the intervention that was tested in this study. And Navigate, I think as we've discussed on other podcasts, is an example of what we now call coordinated specialty care, which is the multi-element, multidisciplinary team-based approach for individuals experiencing early psychosis that has an evidence base. So very briefly, the RAISE ETP or Navigate study included 404 individuals who were recruited at 34 sites around the country. 17 of the sites delivered Navigate or the coordinated specialty care model, and 17 of the sites delivered usual care. And the findings from this study were published in October 2015. And what did the study find? The study found that individuals who received Navigate, or the coordinated specialty care, multidisciplinary, multi-element team-based model, did better. And they did better in terms of reduced symptoms and improved quality of life and a number of other things. And interestingly, there was an interaction with duration of untreated psychosis, such that the shorter the duration of untreated psychosis or time from onset to treatment, the better, the relatively better the outcomes. So that's the background. And one of the interesting things that NIMH is doing now is it is requiring for these kinds of studies that the data be made publicly available.
For secondary analysis.
Right.
Just this very type of secondary analysis.
Exactly. And so they actually, the RAISE ETP folks, you know, shipped their de-identified data, and others, this investigative team, were able then to do an additional analysis.
And just before we dive into that, just so people have a real sense of what Navigate actually is, what are the core components, right? So there's, let me see if I've got it right. There's individual therapy, there's medication management, there's family psychoeducation, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit later in the segment. And what am I missing?
case management,
mm-hmm.
and supported employment and education.
Two big ones.
Right, right. And I think this with the individual therapy piece, it's important to note that it's more on the cognitive behaviorally oriented side than, say, just supportive.
Yeah, and when I've worked with first episode psychosis programs like this,
mm-hmm.
Like On Track in New York, I've been just impressed about how comprehensive it is, mm-hmm. that it's really all of those things are happening at the same time on also a very individualized and personalized level.
Right.
So I think that that's sort of the core thing that people should take home from right. having what they think of when they think of Navigate.
Right. Yeah, and I think maybe just to conceptualize it a little bit. So you've got the program elements, which we've described,
mm-hmm.
and then you've got how the program elements are tied together.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that they're tied together is in this really person-centered, culturally competent, assertive, without being annoying, manner. So it's not, and it's integrated.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, you're not, oh, I have an appointment over here with the case manager, an appointment over there with the supported vocational specialist. That the notion is that it's really a team-based model that really starts with the client or the young person. And I should say that all of these program elements are not strangers to us. We all, you know, there's nothing new here.
Right.
What's new is that they're adapted for young people.
Right. We've talked about this before.
Right.
This should really be the standard of
right.
care, but
right. Right.
We'll get there.
Right.
So again, you've talked about how there's been studies about Navigate, the RAISE ETP study,
mm-hmm.
and this study is looking to see if there are racial and ethnic disparities in outcomes, and also how those individual components of treatment were applied to different racial and ethnic groups.
Mm-hmm.
So,
what did they find?
Here's what they found. In community care, non-Hispanic blacks had significantly higher scores on subscales of positive symptoms, disorganized thoughts, and uncontrolled hostility, but there were no difference in symptoms between racial and ethnic groups in the Navigate arm.
So, suggesting that Navigate limited disparities and relative to usual care.
Right.
Now let's talk about the use of interventions. And it's an interesting story. So if we look at individual therapy, in Navigate, there was no difference in the use of individual therapy by racial ethnic group. But in usual care, there was less use of individual therapy by non-Hispanic blacks than whites, suggesting that Navigate may have reduced that disparity. Now in family psychoeducation, on the other hand, which by the way, was much less used overall than individual therapy and almost never used in usual care. But in terms of looking at the relative use by different racial groups, in Navigate, non-Hispanic blacks were less likely than non-Hispanic whites to participate in family psychoed. That disparity did not exist in usual care, although Hispanics were less likely to use family psychoed than non-Hispanic whites in usual care. So basically, in family psychoed, usual care had one sort of disparity, and Navigate had another. And overall, Navigate really didn't reduce the disparity in the use of family psychoed.
So my take home from all these findings is that Navigate really reduced the racial and ethnic disparities that were found in usual care, with the exception of family psychoeducation for non-Hispanic blacks.
I agree.
So what do we kind of make of all this? Why is this an important finding?
I think it's important because when we improve care, which Navigate has the potential to do and early psychosis programs in general, it doesn't necessarily mean that we reduce disparities. We can actually increase disparities if we engineer improvements to care, but don't necessarily give everybody access, or if they're only targeting, or if characteristics of that new intervention or new strategy don't apply to all. So this is important in the sense that it's showing that this approach, perhaps Navigate specifically and coordinated specialty care more broadly, has the capacity both to improve care and reduce disparities. And clearly we have to look at the family psychoed component of that and try to understand why that piece didn't really operate the way the rest of the program components did.
Right. I think of it in terms of the Navigate program. First of all, if you were going to design a program that might reduce racial and ethnic disparities, you would probably come up with something similar to Navigate, partially because it's so comprehensive and ends up applying all of these really important pieces in an integrated way and on an individual level. So I think there's something maybe about that that is particularly conducive to reducing racial and ethnic disparities.
If it's implemented properly, I mean, you know, I think they need more credit. I think the Navigate creators need a little bit more credit because the devil's often in the details. Like their manuals have to really address how, you know, a particular problem might play itself out.
Yes.
In different populations.
Yes. And so the other way that I think that, and the authors mentioned this, mm-hmm. is fidelity to the model. Mm-hmm. So if you have a model that is potentially conducive to reducing disparities, and then you're really dedicated to sticking to the model, mm-hmm. it's, I think, a way to make sure that everybody is getting the same sort of treatment. And this paper is really important because it shows that, hey, wait a second, this is doing really a good job in reducing these disparities, but let's take a look at family psychoeducation and make sure there's something we can do to improve this one little aspect for this particular group.
Right. Yeah. I well said, Josh. And on the family psychoed front, I think what's striking about it is the program component that is least used in both conditions and almost never used in community care. And, you know, in spite of the fact that we know how important families are in the lives of these young people experiencing early psychosis, and it's my view, and, you know, people who know me know I can get on my soapbox about this, that we need to be much more flexible than even family psychoed is in terms of how we attempt to include families in care. We really need to be more family-centered and not try to deliver a specific model to everybody. And, you know, I think family psychoed as a specific approach is really valuable, but it can't, we have to, I think, be somewhat broader and enriched, because not all families, I think, clearly are going to go for that kind of a model. And we should have other things for them, even if it's just being in touch at the time of crisis or coming in for a few sessions of information, or, you know, whatever else people come up with. I think we need to be more flexible with families.
So some potential to tweak a model that seems to be doing good work for the population and reducing disparities. Mm-hmm. Next up, we have Stephen Lopez and colleagues on psychosis literacy among Latinos with first episode psychosis and their caregivers. So, what's mental health literacy? They define it as knowledge and beliefs about mental disorders which aid the recognition, management, or prevention. This is a really important topic.
Absolutely. I've been wanting to publish something on literacy for a while, and I actually am interested in publishing more articles on literacy. So, if you're listening and you want to study this, please submit articles.
Yeah, and it relates to the last article we talked about, mm-hmm. not just about being about first episode psychosis and not just being about cultural issues, but also literacy, I think, is something that plays a part in some of the things we were talking about family psychoeducation in the last paper. What people are bringing to these interactions mm-hmm. based on their knowledge, I think, is really important in how they interact with these models of care that we're providing.
Yeah, it's in some ways, you know, as a journal that is focused on community, literacy is important in how community members really experience, understand, and then ultimately act or not act upon the possibility of mental illness.
Yeah. So the paper addresses a number of limitations in prior research around mental health literacy, particularly in psychosis. So first of all, they're looking at consumers and caregivers rather than just like a community sample. They're also looking at Latinos in particular, which addresses a gap in mental health literacy research on racial and ethnic minority populations. And then they're also broadening a definition of illness attribution, which I've learned is a key concept in measuring mental health literacy. So usually researchers say that people have mental health literacy when they can identify symptoms as being associated with an illness. So in this case, someone who can identify hearing voices as being the result of schizophrenia would have a high mental health literacy. Mm-hmm. So they're expanding the definition to include just being able to identify symptoms as a potential issue as illness attribution.
Right. Symptom, something actually as a symptom that is a symptom of something.
That's right. They don't necessarily have to identify it as being schizophrenia or psychosis, but just saying,
oh, that's a symptom.
Yes.
Gee, you have a symptom.
Yes. Another way they're expanding it is to say, some people might say, oh, that is that person, because they're having delusions, hallucinations, those are symptoms of a serious mental illness.
So more broadly speaking than schizophrenia.
That's right. So the last thing that they're doing is they want to know if people would seek professional help when they hear about somebody having these symptoms. And
whether having a high level of literacy relates to or influences the likelihood of seeking professional help.
That's right. So here's how they tried to figure this out. They took 79 consumers with first episode psychosis and 69 caregivers to create their sample, which they recruited from a clinic, an inpatient unit, and an emergency department. And they had them watch a 4-minute video of an actress describing a fictional family who has a daughter named Olga, who is experiencing psychotic and depressive symptoms.
Right. So these were all young people with first episode psychosis and their family members.
That's right. So first they asked them, though, what are the signs and symptoms of a serious mental illness? And they rated them from 0 to 3 as to whether or not they included delusions, hallucinations, and disorganized speech. So that created a psychosis knowledge score. So I'm going to intermingle some of the results as I'm talking mm-hmm. about their methodology. So the caregivers scored higher than consumers on this psychosis knowledge score, and both groups reported hallucinations more than they did delusions mm-hmm. and disorganized speech. So they show them this video and they ask them, what is happening to Olga? And if the people described the symptoms, delusions, hallucinations, and disorganized speech, they scored them as a 1. They also asked them, why do you think so? If they mentioned psychosis or schizophrenia, they were scored a 1.
Right. In other words, if they noted the symptom, they asked sort of, where does this come from? Why do you think so? Why is this present?
That's right. Mm-hmm. And then they asked, does Olga have a serious mental illness? And if they said yes, again, they were scored as a 1. So this is getting at that illness attribution that we were just mm-hmm, talking about. Mm-hmm.
You know, and of course, I have to remind everybody that these were all people who had either experienced first episode psychosis or their caregivers. So they were not naive to the experience of psychosis.
Right. Again, not a community sample.
Right.
So both caregivers and consumers were better able to identify the delusions, the hallucinations, the disorganized speech as symptoms or as a serious mental illness, rather than being able to define it as a particular illness. So just to give a sense, 38% of consumers and 65% of caregivers identified Olga as having a serious mental illness, compared to 9% of both groups actually identifying her as having psychosis or schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. So finally, they asked them, what should Olga's parents do to help her? So 41% of consumers and 74% of caregivers advised seeking professional help. So they did a logistic regression to see what predicted seeking professional help, and they found that caregivers were more than twice as likely than consumers to suggest seeking professional help. And attributing the symptoms to serious mental illness increased the odds of seeking professional help by more than 3 times. So
it was important. I mean, this is totally logical, that if the participants understood the symptom as indicative of a serious mental illness, then they were more likely to say help is needed, as opposed to if they just identified it as a symptom.
That's right. So one of the author's big take-home, actually, is that there's pretty poor literacy among consumers about psychosis. mental health literacy among this population is pretty low. There's better literacy among the caregivers, though.
I think that this is an impressive study, given the fact that all of these individuals have been through psychosis, have experienced it either in themselves or their family, and still struggled to identify it. It tells us how much work we have to do to engage community members and even, you know, our consumers and families in the process of understanding this and understanding these phenomena and helping them at least to see how, you know, the profession sees it. They may have alternative explanations, and there's a whole lot that this paper did not really discuss that is important in terms of what these individuals did believe if they didn't recognize it, what was going on as psychosis. And maybe how they did understand it is actually the key to engaging them in sharing with them the profession's understanding. But it's you know, there's a lot of work to be done. And I think the notion that caregivers are a little, are considerably, you know, have greater literacy. Again, there's a number of implications to that, and there's a number of explanations. But, you know, not the least of which is when it's happening to you, sometimes it's harder to recognize. And who knows? I mean, we don't know if the individual consumers who were participating in this study, you know, what their actual condition was and how much they could attend and, you know, what was going on with them at this time. But it does instruct us that there is a different perspective that consumers and caregivers have, and we need to sort of think about and approach them, you know, in their own unique ways.
One question that this brought up for me is, what is important about mental health literacy? Is it important for people to know or to say, Johnny has schizophrenia or Johnny has psychosis, or is the important thing that they are seeking mental health treatment, or is the important thing that they are, I think to me, the important thing would be that they would be able to engage with the person that they're caring for in a therapeutic way. And then this paper really focuses in on how are we going to do that in a way that's culturally specific and appropriate and sensitive. Really interesting questions. And I think, again, with our last paper, we can sort of start thinking through how we might be able to apply this to some of the programs that we actually already have in
yeah, one use. Can argue that the notion of having a clear, defined diagnosis like schizophrenia in the context of just the presence of psychotic symptoms without really any other additional information is problematic.
Right.
And that it may be part of what we're learning here is it may not be useful to very quickly arrive at or communicate about diagnoses, particularly if there's any uncertainty. And in fact, the whole open dialogue notion that is taking hold in so many places advocates, I think, really living with uncertainty in a more proactive way. So I think, you know, at the beginning of this presentation of this paper, I said that I wanted more papers on literacy. And I think, you know, now, after doing this podcast, I wanted even more because I think there's so much to learn and it has so much, many implications for help seeking, for providing treatment in a culturally relevant manner.
Okay, a lot of papers coming your way. And finally, we have Rebecca Toney and colleagues with Mike Slade as a senior author on mechanisms of action and outcomes for students in recovery colleges. So like you mentioned in the intro, this was a concept that was new to both of us.
Yeah. When I saw this article come in, I was like, whoa. And I read the introduction. I said, how come I don't know about this? And then I sent it to a colleague and I said, do you know about this? Close colleague. And he said, I don't know. This was in the United States. I don't know about this either. And I said, wow, well, this really then, it was upsetting that we have this disconnect globally, but it seemed very important to bring this into the American audience.
Right. So this is actually recovery colleges are a movement that they were developed in the United States, actually, but they've caught on more internationally, particularly it seems like in the United Kingdom, where there's now more than 80. Mm-hmm. And that's only since 2009. So it's really taken off there.
Right.
And the idea is, again, like many recovery-oriented services, it's based on moving away from a model of treatment and towards one. This one is towards a model of adult education. So just to kind of...
Yeah, sort of like treatment's not treatment. Treatment is education.
That's right. So in these recovery college, students who can be people using mental health services, can be their families, can be mental health professionals, they enroll in courses that really crucially are co-taught by peers and clinicians or topic experts. The people with a lived experience, though, the peers, are really involved and co-produce the curriculum and all the programming for the recovery colleges.
So just, I mean, think of the words here. The language is so important. Co-produce the curriculum and the programming. And it's not delivering treatment.
That's right. So the courses themselves could be on mental health issues and treatment modalities, rebuilding life, life skills, developing peer skills, providing family support. Actually, really interesting classes. I'd kind of like to sign up for a couple of them.
How about that? And again, it's being presented not as treatment per se, but as part of a curriculum of a college.
Right. So there's some initial evidence that points to improved outcomes for recovery colleges. But this paper is really taking a step back and trying to figure out a theoretical model for how recovery colleges might work and how they might actually induce change in students' lives.
Right, so it goes without saying this is not a randomized trial.
It is not a randomized trial, but we are very welcoming of many different types of studies here on the podcast.
Right. And the first study that we talked about was a randomized trial.
Yes, we got one in.
One RCT.
Okay. So in terms of their methods, on one hand, it's pretty straightforward. They're doing a literature review, they're doing qualitative interviews, but there really is a key difference here. For this research, they created a panel made up of 9 students of recovery colleges, some non-student mental health service users, and also family members, and they became co-researchers on the study. And they really helped create the theoretical model and also write up the report.
So if you think of this paper and you want to think of 2 letters that characterize this paper, those 2 letters are C and O, co.
Yes.
This is all about co. It's all about with. It's all about doing together.
Right. And the actual back and forth between the qualitative researchers and this panel that they created is a little bit complicated. But basically, the panel came together and created an initial theoretical framework for how recovery colleges might work. So they're looking for mechanisms of action and outcomes. So this initial framework guides a literature review, which then creates more potential mechanisms of action and outcomes. And then it goes kind of back and forth to the panel, who work to kind of revise and refine it. And then there's actually another literature review step in there. So a lot of back and forth, but again, 2 letters. Co. Everything is with the input of this panel of 9 people with lived experiences and their family members.
Yeah, and I think very consistent with studies that use qualitative methods, it's iterative.
Right. So after a lot of these iterations, they settled on a model that recovery colleges work by creating a friendly, welcoming, and empowering environment that, in combination with this emphasis on personal growth, allows relationships to develop that are different from those that would normally develop in a treatment setting. So you combine environment, relationships, personal growth, and then power also to create higher expectations about self-efficacy, and then you have change in the student's life.
Yeah, so I think they have a beautiful diagram in this paper, and it's worth looking at when you get the journal. But the notion is that you've got these change mechanisms which involve shifting the balance of power, and that interacts with the capacity to enable different relationships, collaborative relationships, and facilitating personal growth. So you've got this kind of cycle of the shift of power, enabling different relationships, and facilitating personal growth.
And they go into a little bit more in the paper about each of those four mm-hmm. aspects, the environment, power, relationships, and growth. And the power differentials, I think, was one of the more mm-hmm. interesting one. And one of the ways that the power differentials are minimized in the recovery colleges is it really is all a choice to not just to enroll in the college in the first place, but it's also about what classes you take. And then you're also working with people with lived experience.
And there was this detail that brought that to life for me, which is there's no clinician referral.
Right.
It's all self-referral.
Imagine that.
Yeah. And it's just, yeah, which is, yeah, a clinician can say to someone, this might be a good idea, but then the individual ultimately has to make the choice and do the self-referring.
Right. And it seems like a lot of these things are things that you would hope for from a traditional treatment model. Mm-hmm. I mean, they talk about relationships being different in recovery colleges because there's an expectation that both the students and the instructors are going to be changed by the relationship. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that people who come to their practice with a recovery-oriented approach would sort of like to think that they're doing, and I think many people are, but it's really baked in here. It's impossible to miss or to not have, because it's the culture that they've created.
Exactly. And the notion of mutuality.
Right. And then all of this, again, just to get back to their model, is really fostering personal growth, which is what recovery is really all about.
And they talk about, in terms of the outcomes, I think there are two really again, important dimensions of the outcomes. One is the changes in the student. That's the internal experience. And the other are the changes in the student's life.
Right.
Those, I think, are very important distinctions, both dimensions of which are potential outcomes. So, Josh, we've had a lot of conversations about this, and now I want to turn the tables. You usually ask me, why is something important and why do we care? And I want to ask you, why do you think it's important? Why does this matter?
I don't like the direction this podcast is going, Lisa. Well, I think one thing is it expands sort of the horizons for what's available. I think we're getting a little bit caught in the United States about what recovery means and where it can be delivered and how it can be delivered. And so for me, this is a really kind of radical idea, and recovery can be a kind of radical notion. But this is creating kind of a radical institution, even though that's a little bit...
It completely reconceptualizes.
Right. It's actually pretty exciting, too, to think about how we might be able to take this and implement it here in the United States. And also brings up all these questions about, well, why aren't we doing this? Like, what is getting in the way of mm-hmm. us being able to implement something that's seems just like a really, even on its face without this research, just a good idea?
Yeah, well, but again, we need to remember there's no data that these work.
Okay? There's a little data.
There's a little bit of data, and they're quite clear and transparent in the paper that's really, you know, it's unexplored. These are appealing concepts. They're interesting. They're exciting. They're a little bit mind bending for those of us who are been living in a more traditional, even perhaps recovery oriented frame. Because this is saying that we want to think about treatment in a really different way. And I love that. I think without the research, I think it's fair to say there's going to be some really important and valuable things to learn from this approach. And I really look forward to more research. And by the way, I also welcome more papers on recovery colleges.
Even more papers coming to Lisa's desk.
Thanks. Well, that's it for today's podcast. We invite you to visit our website, ps.psychiatryonline.org, to read the articles we discussed in this episode and look at the cool figures, as well as other great research. We also always welcome your feedback. Please email us at psjournal@psych.org. You can also rate and review the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to it. If you like it, please tell your friends about it. I'm Lisa Dixon.
I'm Josh Berzin.
Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next time.
Bye-bye.